There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred with you in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's time to crank up the Wayback Machine and take a listen to a coolest conversations throwback. Remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today's interview is with Jeff Beck, and it first aired July the 15th, 2016, coinciding with the release of his then-solo album, Loud Hailer. On it, he's teamed with Bones UK's Carmen Vandenberg and Rosie Bones. We talk about the album, as well as him making his first guitar when he was 10, seeing Jimi Hendrix, working with Stevie Wonder, and more. But first, let's hear some of our then-coolest song of the week, Live in the Dark. And then I'll be back with Jeff Beck on your Coolest Conversations Throwback, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
I'm not afraid of the dark. If we gotta live in the dark, we will live in the dark. Won't see me dying in the light. I will live in the dark. I'm not afraid of the dark. If we gotta live in the dark, we will live in the dark. Won't see me dying in the light. We will live in the dark.
Mighty Manfred here, and what a big day on our Coolest Conversations, because I have got Jeff Beck on the phone with me now. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
So the new album, Loud Hailer, out today, and on it you're paired with Rosie Bones and Carmen Vandenberg, vocals and guitars from the London-based group Bones, and here in the U.S., I think people familiar with them from that song, Waste of a Pretty Face, gets played in this television show, Orange is the New Black. So I'm told that you wanted to work with them because you wanted to move past guitar nerd albums. Is that right?
Yeah, I knew that would come back and bite me, that one. what I was trying to say was that I didn't want to be sent to stage and recite, you know, pieces. I wanted to get the feel of how it feels to be back in, you know, exciting rock and roll, interacting with vocalists. You know, I do enjoy that. And although I had vocalist guesting on tour, I wanted an album where I could, I don't know, find myself again, you know, in that role. I would just start the process, the day's proceedings, by feeding Rosie with a few ideas and clips that I'd seen, you know, that enraged me, and transported some of those thoughts to Rosie. And she did the rest. And we had an album, beginnings of an album, in the first 3 days.
Wow, that's pretty quick. How did you find out about Bones?
It was Roger Taylor, bless him, who's a great guy, a friend of mine. And it was a lunch thing, and I never expected to see a girl, you know, looking, you know, like a, more like a teenage kind of model, a blues guitarist. And he came over and he introduced me to Carmen and said, she's a guitarist. And I just became inquisitive, what sort of guitar, you know, would a girl like that play? And she says, oh, I play a Telecaster. Right away, the bell rang. And it wasn't one of those sort of girly guitars. It was a difficult guitar, this Telecaster. And I said, well, who do you like? She said, Albert Collins. And I went, bing, bell rang again. So I said, well, you know, tell me about you. She said, well, I'm in a band. You know, not long after that, we went to see them play. phones, and then I thought, these guys are great. But I wasn't looking for a vocalist. I was just toying with the idea of writing some stuff with another guitar player.
Right.
So that was it. I invited the Pervin to dinner that after the gig. And the next thing you know, we're sitting by the fire at my house writing songs.
Well, I saw that, that with Bones, they seem to work with this gentleman. I'm hoping I'm saying his name right. Filippo Shimati, is that right?
Yes, that's producer. Right. Shimati, yes.
Shimati. And he also, co-produced Loud Hailer with you. How would you compare working with him with some of the other producers that you've worked with over the years?
Well, because he already was part, sort of a ghost member of Bones, I think he orchestrates the sound when they're around. It was a tightly knit concern, you know. He understood how to make quick demos, and that's really the key nowadays, and not messing around too much with Pro Tools for hours and hours. Mm-hmm. We let Rosie come up with some lyrics first of all, and then gradually compose the song. And right away, you know, Filippo's on it, and he's putting big drums underneath what sounded pretty, you know, okay, average in backing. And then as soon as he cobbled everything together in the demo form, then we were able to move on to the next vibe, the next groove. So it was a good move on my part to make sure that those three were happy working together.
Right. Well, you know, before we started our chat, we were taking a listen to Live in the Dark, and here in Little Steven's Underground Garage, it's our coolest song of the week. And this writing process that you've described, you know, with Rosie sketching out some lyrics, and then that's how that particular song developed?
Yeah. The internet is to blame for most of it, because I had been studying some horrendous footage of this, that, and the other, and just, you know, trying to not believe what I was seeing. And that was so tied in with their visit, because they said, what are you watching? I said, well, this and that, disgusting world things going on, and people just blithely seem to be carrying on, you know, ignoring it. And so Rosie picked up on that straight away, and there was I can't remember the first song, it probably was Living in the Dark. Rosie will tell you. So that's how it started. I would show them these images and stories that I'd read on YouTube and other places, and various radical channels, or, you know, news channels. Mm. And we'd sit there in disbelief of this is going on.
So that kind of ties into the whole reason that the album's called Loud Hailer. That's like another term for a megaphone. So is this your way of addressing these images and things that you've seen?
Yep. It's the finger pointing is there, you know, and I've never seen so many megaphones. Everywhere you look, there's a megaphone or a demonstration going on. But it just was one of those things, you know, how can we make this? And one of the songs, Revolution, was decided that Rosie would sing through this like a demonstration and start the show with that. I don't know whether we'll do it or not, but sounded like a radical way to start the show.
We've also got a couple of instrumentals on the album, Pull It and Edna. Were those written the same time as the other material?
They were during the guitar parts. Whatever guitars that were on the original track that were keepers, I left alone. And then it was time for me to catch up when the track started to get fully developed with drums, bass, and finished lyrics, finished vocal performances. And once that Karma was happy with what she'd done, then I took a week out, and during that week of overdubbing and replacing various tracks, I came up with Edna, which is about this girl who appears in the hole in the side of the Twin Towers. A mesmerizing picture of this poor lady who, I mean, again, alongside all the others, of course, but how the hell was she still alive in the Twin Towers? You know, standing there in the place where the plane went through.
The track on there, Oil, I guess, O-I-L, that to me has got a, you know, really funky vibe, feel to it. And that had reminded me that I wanted to ask you about that song Superstition, the big Stevie Wonder hit, because you were involved, and I don't think a lot of people know this, but you were involved, at least initially, with its making and writing and arranging, right?
Yeah. I was playing drums in the lunch break. I used to sneak in and play drums when no one was listening. And this was an Electric Lady. And Stevie had gone out to lunch, and he came back to hear me play the trumpet, he can't have known it was me, because I don't play it, you know. He wouldn't have known it was me playing. I said, "Steve, it's me." He said, "I don't care, just a great groove, keep playing." And he got a hold of his clavi there, and I was all of a sudden playing on the track that became Superstition. But it wasn't good enough performance on my part. So right. Steve, he said, "Right, I'll play the drums." And he already had an idea for the song. He took over on that kit, and that was the rest is history. And I had something to do with the lyrics. He asked me about British superstitions. I don't know why, but maybe it was something to do with he'd researched my record, and one of the records was Ain't Superstitious. Maybe that was what triggered him. I don't know. But I fed him all these British superstitions, and lo and behold, out comes a song. So that's how that starts. See, once you come up with that Moog, that bass line, that was all over, you know.
Yeah. And we should point out, too, that, you know, your own version appeared soon after that, Bag Bogart and a Peace album, the debut one.
Yeah.
Now, you're going to be kicking off a three-week U.S. tour starting Tuesday the 19th, playing in Port Chester, New York, and then the next night, Madison Square Garden. Are the Bones ladies playing with you on this tour?
Yeah. They're Carmen and Rosie. They're not Bones. They left Bones on the door. This is a different thing. But, they are playing there.
And who else is in the band?
Okay, Jonathan, my drummer from the last tour, and Rhonda, the Prince's ex-bass player.
And now, Buddy Guy is opening a lot of these shows. You guys must have crossed paths before. Have you played with or hung out much with Buddy Guy over the years?
Yeah, we played not that much together. Some gigs in Pastoria. There's a night of the guitars when Buddy was on. This is going to be a great tour because he was number one choice for me in 1963 when I was working in a paint shop, and a body repair shop. And every lunchtime I'd go around to see if there's any new body material in the record shop. And then I had the fortune to play in a place called Eel Pie Island regularly there every month. And the guy there said, "Next week we've got Buddy Guy coming." I couldn't believe it. And I was in the front row with my body pressed against the stage. I hate crowds, but there was one show that I wasn't going to miss, and I'd never got over it. And the next time that happened was with Jimi Hendrix, who, you know, obviously took a big chunk of Buddy, you know, inspiration. And to know that I'm going to be at this stage of my career alongside Buddy again, I mean, it's just more than I could ever wish for.
We know, mentioning Buddy, and I'm thinking too, you know, when you took over lead guitar duties in the Yardbirds, they were still doing a lot of R&B, blues-rooted things. Now, is that how you came to play guitar through the blues or not?
No, I was more interested in, not obscure, but lesser-known guitar players like Scotty Moore, Cliff Gallup, James Burton, all the great rock and roll records of 56, 57, and then later Chet Atkins.
How old were you when you were starting to play guitar then, and you were hearing whether...
About 14, I would say, when it really started getting serious, when I started cutting out lumps of wood. I actually made a guitar when I was about 10, after seeing a Western film with Roy Rogers in it. I just thought, this is the coolest guy. He's not only playing guitar on a horse, but he's got a Winchester 73 inside the guitar. He used to fire the guitar through the neck. How it worked, I don't know. But it was to me, that was like every schoolboy's dream, having a gun and a guitar at the same time. So it went way back. Let's talk about 10 years old, maybe 9 or 10. But then rock and roll came, and then it rekindled the desire to go to the wood shop and buy some timber and make a guitar. Terrible it was, but I then got a guy who I met through a cycling friend who made me a guitar. And I actually couldn't afford to pay him for it.
Oh.
It was that bad. I think he got the money in the end. But if he didn't, the check's in the post.
You mentioned Jimi Hendrix, you know, seeing Buddy Guy and then seeing Hendrix later on and being sort of pressed to the front of the stage. I want to know if you're familiar with the story. And I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but there's a story where... Hendrix is going to go to England the first time. Chas Chandler wants to bring him over. But Randy California is part of Hendrix's band. And Hendrix, you know, is telling Randy California, "Hey, you still got to come with me. We got to go over to England because we got to find Jeff Beck." So obviously.
Is that what he said?
Good. Yeah, Lord. Yeah. That's the story. So he found you, obviously, right?
Yeah, I'm still trying to get over that. I did say to somebody after the first show I ever saw, which was in this tiny club, the only thing that made it possible for me to leave under my own legs was the fact that he knew who I was. You know, I just thought, well, you know, you've got to take that and just go away and rethink your career.
Well, you're quoted in this. I found this quote from NME's Rock and Roll Years from you, and we'll find out if this is true or not. It's the quote, so everyone thinks of the 1960s as something they really weren't. It was a frustration period of my life. The electronic equipment just wasn't up to the sounds I had in my head. So here we are, 2016. Is the technology there? Are the sounds in your head, or can you get those out yet or not?
Yeah, there's a never-ending quest to get to. I mean, the Fender Strat is the weapon of choice. I mean, it's just incredible. I don't think Leo Fender can possibly have known, you know, what he created. Although he bastardized it in some ways. We've made the vibrato arm a lot more active than it was ever intended to be. The string gauge is now much smaller than was intended. I actually recently restrung my guitar with original strings. It's almost unplayable. They're so fat and tight, but the sound is incredible.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, there's only unlimited possibilities with recording gear, but I'm not really bothered. I'm more, you know, in awe of Jimmy. More time goes by, how he got the sound out of just an amplifier and one pedal. It's pretty much what it was, maybe two pedals. And really, that's the organic sound that I'm more interested in rather than a bunch of pedals. I mean, the slap echo is still the king, and verb when it's called for is great. But you know, most of the time, you want to be left with a bare essential: the guitar, the amp, and your fingers. Really, that's the proof of the pudding. Really.
Let me ask you about amps. I'm sure you've Fender amps and Marshalls. Back in the '60s, did you play through a lot of AC30s or not?
Yeah, I never owned one. That belonged to the Yardbirds, and. It was an instrument that you could have used in the war, and they could have put a grenade in it, and it would still work. I still bear down the inputs and all that, but amazing, you know, and Brian May, I think, still uses them. But it had a mid-range that was great. Hank Marvin used one on Apache, and everybody wanted one. But when we started playing the bigger gigs,
yeah,
I mean, talking about sports arenas, it didn't really carry. So I had some Super Beatles. And there's a picture in the book of me with three Super Beatles. And it got in the newspaper because nobody had ever seen anything that big for one guitar. So I'm probably responsible for, you know, over-the-topness in some ways, a small part in stacks of amplifiers for big metal bands. And if you ask Billy Gibbons, he'll tell you he'd never seen a rig as big as mine.
That's saying something, right?
That was in a small club, though, where it was barely possible to get the amp stacked up without it touching the ceiling.
So on the opening track of Jeff Beck's group's debut album, Truth, you do a version of Shapes of Things. And the story I've always heard is that Rod Stewart had asked you about recording the song, and you said, yes, provided it was slowed down and made dirty and evil. So is that true? And secondly, first of all, is that true? And secondly, listening to the new album, is Slowed Down, Dirty and Evil still where it's at?
Of course. The dirtier, the slower, the better.
Very cool. Did Stewart actually come to you and ask you to say?
Well, he loved the Yardbirds and he loved that song. And I said, look, we just, you know, instead of doing it in the vampy way, it was great in the Yardbird version because I got to change the rhythm halfway through, which is almost a signature of Yardbirds, you know, For Your Love stopped halfway through and went into a half-time groove thing. I actually got to do an Indian-style solo in it with a raga-type rhythm underneath. And that opened up possibilities for me as a lead guitarist in a band. You know, I can mess up this song big time by changing this part of it or that part.
And, here's one thing I wanted to ask you about just in general. It was 5 or 6 years ago, you had an accident where you cut your finger pretty badly. How are those magic hands doing these days, and have you insured them since?
The cool. I better upgrade the insurance. I did snip the top off the first thing, left hand, came almost completely off. I had this marvelous man who is a specialist for musicians and for accidents, especially people who cut carrots lengthwise. You don't do that. They roll over and then you get trouble. But he stitched that back and it was amazing. You know, you can't see the joint anywhere. The feeling's only just recently come back. The tingle's gone. There was a tingle there, right, where the nerve hadn't quite joined up. But, yeah, I was back on the... I really was freaking. I thought that would be the end of me. I do need that finger. You know, any other one, maybe another one.
Right, right. Well, in fact, there's a story little Stephen there doesn't especially like to shake folks' hands because he's so concerned about, you know, people grabbing onto his hands and just squeezing his fingers.
Oh, you wouldn't believe some of the handshakes that I've actually... I could sue. They seem to take great pleasure in crunching your hand to a pulp. I don't know why they do that.
Man. Hey, well, speaking of the slow down, dirty and evil, I want us to take a listen to another track off the new album, Lout Hailer. The song's called Right Now. And I'm thinking it's got, you know, seeking immediate or instant gratification or oriented about fame, people seeking fame in the music business. You've seen trends come and go, staked out your own career that doesn't really depend on these ebbs and tides. But from your vantage point, is that still a thing in the music business where these people are just going after the fame or how
sure,
do you...
Yeah, yeah. Well, I did put this scenario to Rosie and on a daily basis. I tried to put my input because she so quickly and succinctly read what I was trying to say. And this particular day was dealing with those people that are trying to, you know, be famous, even though they know that it's going to be for 5 minutes, or the Andy Warhol 5 minutes thing, you know?
Yeah.
In particular, the shows over here, the Britain's Got Talent, you know. If you're looking for a performing dog, you'd probably find one, but there's not much I would call talent. These people would do, like 30,000 people, wannabes, you know, instead of learning to do to write and be unique, they just sing a cover just so they can say, I've been on television. That's what the song is basically about. And it's a sad thing that people don't really want to spend time finding who they are and putting over unique songs, you know, in a homebrew way. I don't think many of the contestants on those shows actually wrote their own material. Maybe one or two. And there were some, you know, once in a blue moon, somebody could really sing, but most of the part was just bad karaoke. That's what the song, I guess, is about.
So have you found out who you are?
No.
It's a journey, right?
I don't want to know. No, I can't stand the bit I do know.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you very much. I hope I didn't make too much of a fool of myself.
No, not at all. Not at all, man. Pleasure speaking with you, right? Let's take a listen now. Here's Right Now from Jeff Beck's latest album, Lout Hailer and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.